Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today was originally from Boston, Massachusetts. Author NEXT spent 20 years in the music industry, then nearly 10 years ago moved to Los Angeles to pursue film production. During his music industry days, NEXT traveled to all 50 states, including a visit to Chico. He and his wife decided to move to Chico to raise their daughter. They found Chico to be a wonderful place for a family with beautiful nature, mountains, organic produce, and clean water. When he decided to write a book about the Luxor Temple, NEXT and his family moved to Egypt and lived in Egypt for 2 years before returning to Chico. The title of his book is The Adept Initiate's Guide to Luxor Temple, Experiencing the Temple of Man Using the Esoteric Symbolist Approach. NEXT, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me, Nancy. It is an honor and pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. This is such a departure from what you normally were doing professionally that I thought, how did he happen to get interested in this?
That is a long story, and when we say this, there is so much that could be said, as with the book itself, you know, because I have an interest in Egypt, I have an interest in temple architecture, I have an interest in esoteric traditions and symbolism, ancient civilizations, and so forth, and all of this, Egypt in particular, I think with most people, we see images when we're very young and we're drawn to it, and I think as I got older, my quest for trying to explore the world's various traditions and religions put me on this quest to look for something deeper, something more, going in and looking at the root of a lot of these traditions. And actually, Chico is what brought me to Egypt, interestingly enough. Now, I had known that I wanted to go to Egypt. I started having these dreams, these recurring vivid dreams, and some weird synchronicities that lined up that told me that this was going to be the year I go to Egypt. Now, this is a decade ago, and I didn't know how. I didn't know when. Interestingly enough, I was just coming out of a long bout, several decades working in the music industry, and I had transitioned into film. That's why I moved from Massachusetts to Los Angeles originally. And I met a glass artist from Chico as part of a documentary film project I was working on. And he explained to me his story about living in Egypt for a year. And long story short, that resulted in another documentary project, a film. So I went to Egypt not as a tourist. You know, most people go there as a tourist to see the sights. I went there as a film producer to make a documentary, but as someone that's had a passion or a penchant for exploring the ancient civilizations. And when we got there and I came face to face with the hieroglyphs, I had to know more. I had to know what this language was saying. And so, here we are over a decade later, and I'm leading tours to Egypt and writing books about the temples.
And my guest is NEXT, and he has written a book, a guidebook to Luxor Temple. And do you know, I was so curious, how did he get interested in this? And I opened your book to the acknowledgments, and you say, you are grateful to my adored Egyptian sister. And I'm not even sure how to pronounce Sohela Hussein. So is that true? You have an Egyptian sister? Oh, not blood sister.
Not but, literally. Metaphorically, perhaps. It's, she's not a blood sister. I consider Sohela my sister. So again, I've been leading tours to Egypt for over 10 years. Sohela is a licensed Egyptology tour guide. She studied Egyptology. And I sort of inherited Sohela from my mentor, the late, great symbolist author, John Anthony West. He was Emmy Award winner. He had the Emmy Award winning documentary. I don't know if you remember this, Nancy, in the early 90s that was hosted by Charles Heston. It was on NBC. It was a huge special because John Anthony West was proposing his theory, which was juxtaposed or diametrically opposed to the traditional timeline established in Egyptology for the Great Sphinx at Giza. John believed that the Sphinx was much older, and they had this documentary. And I remember watching it when I was very young. Long story short, I ended up studying under John Anthony West in Egypt, and Sahila was John's official licensed Egyptologist tour guide that accompanied all of his tours for decades. And when he transitioned into the afterlife, when he passed on a few years back, Sahila continued to do, we carry on the same tradition as my mentor, leading these symbolist tours of Egypt.
Well, you know, one thing, I was stunned by my ignorance of all these things that you put in your book. I thought, my gosh, why didn't I know that? No, not everything, but I was, like I said, I was stunned by what I did not know that I learned in your book. And this person you mentioned, John Anthony West, he just 2018, he lived to be 85, so he only recently passed, this John Anthony West. And he, as you mentioned, he led symbolist study tours to Egypt. And that's how you happened to, I'm going to say, the privilege of meeting this person.
Absolutely. It was an honor and a privilege, and a long but interesting story that I often tell on my trips to Egypt of coming together with John Anthony West. I had the esteemed privilege of filming him, actually, and documenting him. So I was filming every aspect of his tours. And, you know, when I first went to Egypt, I went with my own limited understanding and ignorance. I went based on what I knew or what I was taught in the textbooks. But being able to travel with John, it really opened me up to seeing Egypt in a different way. That is, seeing Egypt through the eyes of a symbolist. You know, when we go into the temples in Egypt, you can look at the hieroglyphs and you can read the hieroglyphs. You know, when you look at the symbols, there's a certain conventions. You can read hieroglyphs left to right, right to left, top to bottom, never really bottom to top, unless it's what's called honorific transposition. It's a concept in Egyptology. Anyway, so, you know, we can read the hieroglyphs. That's what Egyptologists do. But John would read into the hieroglyphs, the inner meaning, the principles themselves. We can liken this to some esoteric traditions, say, for example, tarot cards. You can look at the images of the tarot cards, and a reader can, they'll either receive divine influence or use their own subjective feelings, or, you know, a true esotericist can look at the symbols and determine the planetary attributions, you know, the color symbolism. There's a lot of different aspects which tell the elements, which tell a story about the image, the archetypal image that you're looking at. And that's what I found fascinating, because you can read hieroglyphs if you learn how to do so. And then you can also learn how to read them at a deeper level, and not just the hieroglyphs themselves, because there's another language that's happening in Egypt that we're not really paying attention to. And that is the beautiful language of architecture. The architecture, the geometries, proportions, symbolism, and art, they all tell a story.
My guest is NEXT, and his book is a guidebook to Luxor Temple. And I was wondering about somebody you mentioned who had a huge role before John Anthony West. And so I wondered about this guy, Schwaller de Lubritz. And I thought, well, he must have written something. So I looked on Amazon, and sure enough, there's this book that he wrote on the temple. And on sale, it was $165.
That's a good price, because I purchased the book for over $200 some years back. Yeah, it's a very expensive and very dense book. Let's just say Schwaller isn't exactly nighttime reading. It's not a light read. It's very dense. And, you know, most people find Schwaller to be a difficult read. It came a little easier to me because I had years of study in the Western esoteric tradition, so a lot of the concepts came to me a little quicker. But I realized, like my mentor before me, who had also wrote his book, Serpent in the Sky, We wanted to take Schwaller's work and make it more palatable. But even my mentor, John Anthony West, you know, even if you read Serpent in the Sky, you'll find a lot of the concepts are very heady. So what I wanted to do with this book is really distill it down and make a, you know, paying homage to those who came before me, or shall we say, standing on the shoulders of giants. And I wanted to make a more palatable, you know, easier to read version so that if you're going to Egypt, you could use this guidebook on the bus, on your way, or even if you don't have the opportunity to experience Egypt, just reading the book could take you through the temple itself. As author Laird Scranton says, he provided an endorsement for the book, and he refers to how the book is literally the next best thing to experiencing the temple itself. But R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch is not a name that most people are familiar with. However, his work was perhaps, as my mentor would say, one of the most important works in scholarship in the last, you know, couple of centuries, perhaps. Schwaller had, he was an Alsatian, that's French and German, operating alchemist. His father was a chemist. He too was a chemist. He was a mystic, and he was a rogue or independent Egyptologist. So he didn't have, you know, he didn't go through the formal university training, but he studied Egyptology independently. And he, like myself and his wife and his stepdaughter, had moved to Egypt, and he studied the Luxor Temple for over 15 years, stone by stone, right down to the millimeter. He had the benefit of the French Egyptological mission who was working there at the time to help provide the exact measurements. And from that, he was able to determine the proportions and geometries that command the architecture of the temple, that it all lines up with the biometric makeup of the human body. And so it's not even just that his daughter, Lucy Lamy, put together the illustration superimposing the skeleton, accurate reflection of a typical male skeleton over the temple. And it's not just that you can put an image of the skeleton over the temple, but within the temple, the symbolism, art, and architecture all line up with the occult or hidden anatomy of the human inherent in a temple. And so this was a way for, according to Schwaller, for the ancient Egyptians, in a way to give life to the temple. It's living stone architecture. And more so, the thing that I find most fascinating is that when we look at temples, we think of places of worship. But when we look at the Luxor Temple through a symbolist lens, through an esoteric approach, we come to realize that it's more like a three-dimensional textbook offering teachings that are valuable even to this day. The practical application that one can extract from the temple, it's like taking modern wisdom for, it's like taking ancient wisdom for modern living.
Well, I find that we don't know if a culture did not leave a written language, a written record of something. We have to just imagine what some of this, the meaning of some of these things. For example, the Greeks wrote down things, so we know all about the Greeks. And as I was reading your book, I thought, well, gosh, in my own mind, I've given the Greeks a lot of credit for what really I should be giving the Egyptians credit for. And that was kind of a surprise for me. Now, people may not be very familiar with Egypt. They say, well, I've heard of Cairo, but where is Luxor?
Ah, that's a great question. So geographically speaking, Luxor is in what's known as Upper Egypt, although you don't want to confuse that because it's actually the south. It's down on a map. The reason why it's called Upper Egypt, so it's south of Cairo. The reason why it's called Upper Egypt is because further down on a map, or further in the Upper Egypt scheme, is Aswan and the cataract. And this is from where all the water flows. So the Egyptians had this view of creation, this before creation even, this primordial abyss. And so all life comes from the Nile. All life was around the Nile, and the Nile flows from the south to the north. It's one of the few rivers in the world that flow this way. So it's actually coming down. As you're in the northern part of Egypt, Cairo or Alexandria, then Cairo, and you're moving further south toward Aswan. I'm sorry, further south toward Luxor, and then eventually Aswan before you get to the Sudan border. You're actually going up a plateau where the water's not a plateau, but you're going up the landscape and the water's coming down. So Luxor is south of Cairo in what's known as Upper Egypt, where Cairo and Giza are Lower Egypt.
My guest is NEXT, and he's written a guidebook, The Adept Initiate's Guide to Luxor Temple. We'll be back after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is NEXT, and his book is The Adept Initiate's Guide to Luxor Temple. And it took me a while to read your book because I would come to something, oh, I want to know more about this. And besides the book itself being interesting, so one of the sidetracks was to find out more about Schwaller because I thought, what an odd name this guy has. And then I thought, oh, Swiss, Alsace. And so I saw why he had this kind of unusual name. And then another thing that I thought, oh, I've been to the Place de la Concorde in Paris, but I never knew the obelisk there had a twin.
Yes. So if you go to the Luxor Temple today, you will notice that there's only one obelisk, which is actually a Greek corruption of the word tekenu. The concept is corrupted because when the Greeks seen the obelisk, they saw meat skewers, obeliskos, obelisk. However, the ancient Egyptian word was tekenu, which meant to pierce, as in to pierce the sky. It was like an arrow, and symbolically, it also represents the soul's journey. Everything has multiple meanings in Egypt. But if you'll notice, right outside the what are called pylons, these enormous towering gates before proceeding into the temple proper, there's an obelisk on the left-hand side, the east side of the temple. But it's missing its significant partner. Every time you go, you know, the Egyptians did nothing haphazardly. They had an affinity for symmetry. Before entering every temple, you had two pylons. Often you would have two obelisks. So where did it go? Well, years ago, originally the British wanted to take it. They couldn't take it. And long story short, the French took it home where it rests today. And, interesting but sad fact is there's actually more obelisks outside of Egypt today than there are in Egypt.
Well, there's so much that we rely on your photographs, essential in your book, your photographs and your sketches, your diagrams, explaining these things. And even on the cover of your book, I thought, that's odd. Here are these skeletons, and their feet aren't side by side. And I would not have noticed until I read your book, there's a difference in which foot is forward of the other foot. The feet are not side by side. And what was that all about?
Yeah, so again, the Egyptians had, this rich symbolism in all their art and architecture, and often you'll find the skeleton, or in general, any statue in Egypt, you'll notice the feet are actually side by side, which symbolically represents the deceased. So it's the Osirian concept, Osiris. The king becomes Osiris in the afterlife. And so when the feet are side by side, it's immobilized. It's like death. Not death as an ending, because with the ancient Egyptians or esoteric traditions, we see death as a transition. Now, when the statue is alive or active, you'll notice the left foot is forward. Left foot first. Why the left foot? Because on the left side of the body, we have the heart. And for the ancient Egyptians, the heart was the seat of consciousness.
Yeah, so I found that fascinating that they made that distinction between putting the left foot in front of the right foot instead of side by side.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, if you look at the temple, Nancy, from an aerial view, it has this unusual skewed axis. Now, this breaks typical temple building protocol.
It's not symmetrical.
It's not really symmetrical, which is unusual. So, you know, there's a few different theories. Was it to align the Nile? Was it astronomical? Was it, you know, Schwaller was able to intuit that this was all intentional. You know, every temple grows out organically. It's like a seed. It starts in what's known as the inner sanctum, or what we call the Holy of Holies, or the Atidom. And then the temple, from there, they set the four corners on sacred space. And what I mean by sacred space is any area where terrestrial forces converge with the cosmic. You have a sacred space. And when I say cosmic, I'm referring to, you know, every morning we have the magnetic storms that affect the Earth, and you have terrestrial spaces where you have what's known as there's a continuity underground of different minerals and so forth. And where you have a continuity discontinuity, you know, often you can have different electromagnetic properties, if you will. Anyway, these sacred spaces, and often they're aligned to astronomical events or the stars. The Egyptians would contain this sacred space, and, you know, with four corners, giving it material substance, bringing the immaterial into the material, the unseen into the seen, and then they would grow it out from that. It's like a seed that bears fruit, and the temple grows outward. But what's unusual, and over time, what's unusual is this temple skews. Schwaller intuited that that was all intentional, because you can look at an aerial view of the temple with the skeleton superimposed from a frontal view, but if you put it on its side profile with the left foot forward, everything corresponds that way. So the symbolism actually works at more than two levels, actually. But you can see it works from a front view, from a side view, and then it also works through, this is a very complex subject, which Schwaller also covers in his book.
That's why your images are helpful in your book. Essential.
Yeah, essential images. The diagrams help break this down and explain it. But even the temple itself, the earliest parts of the architecture, the oldest parts of the temple are the child. You can see in the book, I provide a diagram for the child that can be found within the Luxor temple. And then it grows out to the full man, because a temple is representing not just the journey of man coming into being. This is everything in Egypt is cosmology, the story of coming into creation, but also the path of return to source. And what I find really fascinating about this temple, which just blows me away, is the fact that when you're walking through the Luxor temple, you are literally walking through the body of man. You're walking through the feet, the two pylons, up the legs, the femur bone, into the stomach, all the way to the head, to the pineal gland, the third eye. And it is just all expressed in the symbolism and art and architecture. And it's absolutely amazing. It's like taking a journey through yourself. And that's why we call it the esoteric approach, because the word esoteric comes from the Greek eso, which means inner. So you're effectively going inside yourself when you go through the temple.
That is the subtitle, Experiencing the Temple of Man Using the Esoteric Symbolist Approach. And the similarities between the layouts of Gothic cathedrals in Europe and the layout of the Luxor Temple, that I found, so this is where they got this idea for the Gothic cathedrals in Europe, particularly in France.
Yeah, that's just the thing, you know, and that is a bit of a mystery, because it's very difficult to many of those who have tried to find, you know, a direct connection. And there's some, you know, loose pieces of evidence out there. But in the Renaissance, you know, is really where we bring back a lot of the Hermetic wisdom of the ancients, of the Egyptians, specifically, you know, in Italy, and its travels all throughout Europe. But there was a knowledge that went into the Gothic cathedrals by the builders, the masons who, you know, originally constructed those cathedrals. And they're brilliant. They're encoded with sacred geometry and symbolism. And it's not only just symbolic, you know, for the intellect, but it is intended to have an impact on you. You know, the great Russian mystic George Ivanovich Gurdjieff refers to the concepts of objective art and subjective art. And that's what this temple is. It, you know, subjective, we listen to different music. It has an impact on us, you know, depending on our preferences or our tastes and our own, conditioning. Whereas objective art, no matter what, it's going to have an impact. And it's the geometries and proportions that align with harmony and music. My mentor would say going through the Luxor Temple is like going through, you know, a guitar. It's like a musical instrument because you're effectively vibrating with the temple. As you know, Nancy, from going in those Gothic cathedrals, you get a sense of awe when you're in there. The stained glass lights and the reverb of the sound, it all has impact on you. Yeah. The same.
I'm not even Catholic, but I know what you're describing right there. Oh, my gosh. Well, now, since you mentioned Gurdjieff, I thought it was interesting that he says that our existence, human existence, is part of a magnetic field over which the moon governs. And I don't think we would normally expect that.
Yeah, Gurdjieff has some interesting concepts, and that's one of the things that I found most fascinating about my mentor. You know, a lot of people know John Anthony West for his redating the Sphinx theory, but I was really drawn to his depth of esoteric knowledge, and he was a practitioner of Gurdjieff's Fourth Way teachings and, you know, sent me on this path of studying Gurdjieff, which took, you know, after my study trip with John and learning from John, it took me years to get through the material of Gurdjieff and his students and Schwaller, you know, to finally put a lot of this stuff together, which culminates into this book. But yeah, it's very interesting, and it's interesting about the moon because in astrology, the moon in the heart, you know, the correspondences line up with the temple, and we have the heart center of the temple inside the Luxor Temple of Man, as well as the moon. I'm sorry, in astrology, the heart aligns with the sun and the moon aligns with the lungs. And so when you're going through the Temple of Man, you see the moon symbolism in the area of the temple that corresponds to the lungs in the human body. And what's fascinating is when you actually look at the temple design, you can see that you have the waxing and waning of the moon at the ground level where the columns are. It's brilliant. I mean, it's really, you know, reading the book is really the next closest thing to experiencing it, but there's nothing like actually experiencing the temple firsthand, as we do on my tours, which you can learn more about it at adeptexpeditions.com.
Well, but I'm just imagining listeners saying, hey, wait a minute. He doesn't have any evidence. He's making all these claims. This just is a little too much. I can't go along with this. What's this guy thinking? And so how do you respond to skeptics?
Yeah, well, it would depend on the specific question. You know, I myself don't just take everything passively. I don't agree with every aspect of my mentor's theory, and I don't even agree with every aspect of Schwaller's work. But I can see that there is massive practical application to extract from Schwaller's work. Now, there's certainly going to be skeptics. There have always been skeptics. Even when Schwaller was doing this in Egypt, the French Egyptological Mission wanted to erect a common wall of silence around his work. Because these are people that have written books and, you know, in universities, it's a giant book club. And you can't have someone come along and disrupt the paradigm. But what set Schwaller apart is he was approaching Egypt viewing it through an esoteric lens. He was a bit of a prodigy himself. At age 16, he was lecturing before the Theosophical Society, giving a treatise on Pythagorean number mysticism. So when he went to Egypt, he was already looking at this in a different way. He had a broader view, if you will, of interpreting the temple. And so I've had the opportunity to present this material to PhD degreed Egyptologists, the Luxor Temple's inspector of 7 years, Saeed Mustafa, who actually wrote the foreword to my book. And this is unusual because although I have studied hieroglyphs from a professor and I've, you know, been studying this stuff independently for years, I never went to university. I'm not a traditionally trained Egyptologist. And so usually they don't really support those who are outside of the ivory towers. I was very fortunate in the fact that the temple's inspector of 7 years, a bona fide Egyptian Egyptologist, wrote the foreword to the book. And he basically says that the book can stand next to, you know, he recommends it as a source for even academia. And that's the thing about the book. It's not just the esoteric perspective, you're going to get all of the, you're going to have the most comprehensive view of the temple. I've taken the time to actually decode a lot of the hieroglyphs. So you're not just going into a blind, there's actually explanations of the hieroglyphic reliefs. And then I explain how this all corresponds to the occult anatomy of the human body. And I mean, you really just have to experience it for yourself and form your own opinions and judgments. Because again, I don't agree with every aspect of Shuala's work, but I do see a massive amount of practical application that can be extracted from it. And that's why in the back of the book, I include a section on practical applications, which is a synthesis of many different esoteric traditions from around the world, which includes different meditations, sacred vowel sounds and intonations. And so for the skeptics who want to question that and be like, oh, they're just meditating in a temple, this is woo-woo. Well, actually, there's been scientific studies and peer-reviewed journals that demonstrate how some of these sacred vowel sounds, such as the Rosicrucian vowel sounds, are conducive to the human body, particularly our glands, which correspond to the chakras. And all of this is covered in the book, and you're provided with practical applications. This is truly taking the esoteric symbolist approach when you apply this going through the temple, because these are different, again, meditations, vowel sounds, intonations, and esoteric practices that you can use that are beneficial for the human body while you're in the temple of the human body.
My guest is NEXT. His book is The Adept Initiate's Guide to Luxor Temple, Experiencing the Temple of Man Using the Esoteric Symbolist Approach. And you do travel around giving lectures on this ancient knowledge and sacred science and esoteric traditions. And I'm wondering if you have a skeptic who says, wait a minute, NEXT, I've got a question for you. Do you have that they...
I do, quite often. And interestingly enough, I'm a bit of a skeptic myself. I consider myself a mystic in skeptic's clothing. So I approach everything myself with a healthy dose of skepticism. I'm not easily taken in by alternative theories. I need to verify for myself. And so when I present the material on my tours, I present it with an interdisciplinary approach in an unbiased way. I'm going to give you the standard Egyptological academic information that you would get on any other tour. In addition to that, I'm going to lay out a plethora of alternative theories, not just my own, but those of, you know, other colleagues in the field. And I always let my groups decide for themselves. And while you think it might be a hodgepodge of disagreements and disparate, it's actually all of my trips are wonderful experiences where everyone gets along, and that exchange and dialogue and discourse is really what makes the experience what it is. The temples are one thing, but, you know, all these different opinions and ideas. And so I think it's important for skeptics or anyone really to raise their hand and question what they're reading and question material. And I'm happy to provide answers wherever I can. I don't have all of the answers, but I'm happy to, you know, provide the information from my own research and let you know what I think is legit and what I think needs more improvement.
My guest has written a guidebook to Luxor Temple. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. We'll be back after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm back now with my guest, NEXT, who's written a guidebook to Luxor Temple. The Egyptians said that creation emerged out of vibration, And people, well, now, what do you mean by that? Well, they're probably familiar with the Bible, and the Gospel of John begins with the Word. So how does that relate to what the Egyptians said in their Book of the Dead?
Right. In the beginning was the Word. And that's a great question, by the way, Nancy. In the beginning was the Word. And what is Word but vibration? And this is the underpinning of everything. Music is vibration. And these stones are vibrating. And that's one of the things we want to emphasize in the book, because we consider this living stone architecture. The ancient Egyptians also had this concept of animism, that the stones were, you know, very much alive in a sense. They would give life to their statues. The priests would, the lector priests would perform different rituals to bring life, to imbue the statue with life. But they viewed stone, you know, it's a lower vibrational frequency. You have the minerals, then you have the plants which feed on those minerals, then you have the animals which feed off those plants, then you have us humans which feed off all of the below. But the minerals would be a lower vibrational frequency because it's all part of the same plucked string of vibration. It all corresponds to the idea that all is one, that we're all connected. Although physically it doesn't appear that we're connected, I'm on this side of the table, Nancy is opposing me, you, the listener, are listening somewhere else, but we are all connected just through the vibrations of sound right now. And at a grander cosmological scheme, if you subscribe to these ideas, that we all come from the same source. And that was the underpinning of Schwaller's teachings, and that is the underpinning of what is expressed in the, you know, esoterically in the temple architecture itself. The back of the temple, the southern part of the temple, the southern sanctuary, is built on these principles. And again, the geometries and proportions command the architecture to be built in a certain way, which ultimately intends to have an effect on your consciousness and would be used to teach the initiates about that journey, which, you know, you refer to it as the Book of the Dead. It's long been known as that in Egyptology, but it's best viewed as the Book of Coming Forth by Day. And that is effectively expressing the cosmology of coming into being, that is the unseen into the seen, the immaterial into the material, materialistness into form, coming into creation. And then the idea for the ancient Egyptians is to return back to that source. We have to do the work in this lifetime in order to go full cycle, to return back to the source.
You know, you were talking about vibration, and I remember the moment. There's not too much I remember about high school, but sitting in biology class, when this came up about molecules vibrating, and I sit there staring at the desks in that classroom thinking, this is all vibrating.
Yeah, and that's the beautiful thing, you know, because we're vibrating right down to the molecular structure. You think about the anatomy of our cells. We have a whole universe within. And so if you think of the body corresponding to the temple, we are temples. Our body is a living, walking, breathing mystery school. And when I say mystery school, I'm referring to centers of study in the ancient world, like these temples. They weren't just places of worship. They were didactic. The temple itself is the teaching. You're not just reading the text. You're not just learning from a priest. You're experiencing the teaching through the temple, which is effectively an exercise in vibrational, you know, it's visual vibration. It's not sonic vibration. It's visual, which then has an impact on our consciousness, which then has an impact on our psychology and then our physiology. So that's why when you're, you know, there's a science to the awe. When you're standing before this magnificent temple, you're taken in just by the sheer size. But then it's the proportions and geometries that are having an effect, an impact on our consciousness.
Speaking of geometry, you mentioned the role that hexagon and pentagon played in this creation. And so that also made me think, gosh, I want to review my high school geometry. So I can't imagine somebody going through this place without your guidebook. They would miss so much. And for example, one row of over 1,000 temple or repeated images over 1,000 times.
Yes, the Avenue of the Sphinx. And this is something that, you know, there's a lot of people that are familiar with. Well, not a lot. There's a small circle of people that are familiar with Schwaller's work. But, you know, I wanted to make sure in this book that I'm not just echoing my mentor, John Anthony West, or Schwaller's work, that I'm adding my own insights. And so one of the things that I bring in this book is the symbolism of the Sphinxes, which intricately, as you mentioned, is over 1,000 of them in repetition, which also has an impact on your consciousness. It's like a projector film, if you will. There's something about walking down, you know, walking through this pathway, which the Egyptians referred to as Wat Necher, which meant the path of the gods, and which we today call the Avenue of the Sphinxes. And having these repetitive images on the side of us consecutively as you're walking, it has an impact. And so I discussed there's some different sphinxes along that avenue. A lot of people don't realize this. They just see what's known as the Androsphinx, which is the body of a lion with the head of a man, similar to the Sphinx in the Giza Plateau. But if you
and that's walk, the one that most people, when they think of a sphinx, they think of the one in the Giza Plateau.
The Great Sphinx of Egypt, which is an Androsphinx. Now, if you walk up the Avenue of the Sphinxes in Luxor, all the way to where it connects with Karnak, you'll notice that there are different sphinxes, different types of sphinxes. There's a full body ram sphinx, there's a ram head lion body sphinx, cryo-creo sphinx. And so why do we have these different sphinxes? I explain the symbolism. And again, it all has to do with cosmology, the idea that there's this united, undifferentiated consciousness. It becomes aware of itself and it splits into two. And then we have duality and polarity and so forth. And that's all expressed through the Sphinx symbolism, which is on the Avenue of the Sphinx linking to Karnak, which is actually the subject of my next book. This Adept Initiate's Guide is going to be a series. I will also have, I'm working now on a forthcoming book, The Adept Initiate's Guide to the Karnak Temple, which again will be an esoteric look at the temple.
You might mention where Karnak is in relation to Luxor.
Yeah, so it's on the east bank of the Nile in Luxor. It's intricately connected to the Luxor Temple by the Avenue of the Sphinxes. So it's there in Luxor, and it is, in fact, the largest temple complex in all of Egypt, and it would be the largest temple complex in the entire world if it was not for Angkor Wat. And it is absolutely amazing. At first glance, you would think it was haphazardly put together, but when viewed through an esoteric lens, as I'll explain in my next book, it was all with intention. And it was used for a procession. There was the Opet Festival that would take place with these temples. And there's actually other temples on the other side of the Nile River that are all connected in a square. And it was all part of this ritual, what we could say sympathetic magical act exercise that the Egyptians would perform.
The book we're discussing is The Adept Initiate's Guide to Luxor Temple, Experiencing the Temple of Man Using the Esoteric Symbolist Approach. The author is NEXT, and I'm thinking a listener might say, I'd like to know more about his tours and about Egypt, and so how do I Google NEXT?
That's a great question, Nancy. So NEXT is spelled A-N-Y-E-X-T. T-E-E. Again, that's A-N-Y-E-X-T-E-E. And you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all social, TikTok, all social media under that name. My YouTube channel, where I produce a lot of content and videos exploring Egypt and the mysteries, is also under NEXT. But if you would like to come to Egypt and experience Egypt for yourself through the eyes of a symbolist using the esoteric approach, we have the best show in town, and you can find out more at adeptexpeditions.com. That's A-D-E-P-T, expeditions.com. I'll be leading another esoteric Egypt tour this September. We're about 3/4 of the way full. The tour will probably fill up soon. They are absolutely amazing. Unlike your typical these are not your typical spectator tours. We get exclusive access. Nancy, you had mentioned the Sphinx. I'm one of the few groups that if you were to go to Egypt on your own, you'd just get to see the Sphinx from behind a wall. We're one of the few groups to take you inside the Sphinx enclosure in between the paws. You can come up face to face with the Sphinx. You can touch the paws, feel the energy in between. We get private access inside the pyramids, all three chambers, the king's, queen's, and subterranean pit down below. This is not something that's available to the general tourist. This is exclusive to my groups. If you're interested in meditation, we do meditations inside the King's Chamber, and you get all sorts of doors open up. One of the interesting things is I lived in Egypt for 2 years, so my relationships are phenomenal. We get access to many sites and things that most tourists don't get to see. So you can learn more at adeptexpeditions.com.
Well, I think here in the West see columns and we think immediately Greece. But there are so many columns, and that was one thing, the photographs in your book, we see all these columns, and we're used to seeing Egyptians standing, the pharaoh is standing, but you have photographs of seated pharaohs. So what are these seated statues?
Ah, the seated colossi of Ramses, the great Ramses, which is at the entrance to the Luxor Temple and at a few occasions as you're going through the temple. See, again, the temple grows from the back. You would think that, you know, they build everything from the front and in. No, it actually starts in the south, or with a temple, it's always going to be the innermost part of the temple was the first part of the temple. And many of them are built over hundreds or thousands of years of construction phases. So this temple starts in the New Kingdom with Amenhotep III and his genius architect Senamu. And it grows out over time to the point where you have Ramses installing these giant seated colossi. And there's one instance where you have the seated statue at the knees of the temple. So on Schwaller's plan, or on the cover of my book, where you see the skeleton superimposed over the temple, right at the knees, right at the joints, is where we have statues that are seated. And this is one clue that the initiates would be able to take in, you know, to understand that this is, there's more, there's much more. This is just one piece of a greater puzzle, but there's an emphasis placed on the knees. And this is where you have the joint, the statues are positioned right where the joint of the knee would correspond on the human body.
Well, that's one of the points, and I think the reason that Schwaller wrote his book, The Temple of Man, because he presents evidence that the Luxor Temple was built entirely with symbolic intentions in mind. And I think people would really miss that if they didn't have your guidebook. You know, you walk through, oh, well, here's some columns and there's some statues and, okay, let's go eat lunch.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And it's for me, it's tragic as someone that's so passionate and so interested in learning more and wanting to know more. I mean, the typical spectator, maybe they just want to see the temple, take a picture and grow. But if you're into this stuff and you want to learn more about Egypt, I really feel like it's a great injustice in the sense that most tour guides will rush people through that temple. Within 40 minutes, they'll walk through the main passageway and back. Whereas on my tours, we spend at least 2 hours. I had a few instances where I've been paid to do private tours for real enthusiasts. I've literally did one tour, 8-hour tour of the Luxor Temple. We took our time, stone by stone, going over the symbolism. You know, even the 2 hours isn't adequate, but you can get a gist of it. You can get, you know, it's distilled in the book. So if you read the book, it's the next best experience to understanding the deeper esoteric aspects of the temple, which unfortunately most tourists don't see unless they have this book or come on one of the tours.
Well, I don't want to disparage or discredit Greek culture because I've spent time in Greece, but I really think now I'm going to reevaluate the role of Egypt in our world history. So thank you for writing this guidebook.
Thank you, Nancy. And on a final note, just to say, you know, a lot of people think that the sacred geometry and the architecture and the columns, it was credited to the Greeks. But when you look at the famed Greek philosophers, Plato, Pythagoras, all of them, they all credit the Egyptian mystery schools. They all went to Egypt to learn. And you can find evidence of Doric columns in Egypt, yeah, 1,000 years before the Greeks had them. And that's what Schwaller went there. He wanted to see if they had pi and phi and these, you know, mathematical ratios in the architecture. And sure enough, it's all there in Egypt. It was all there from the beginning.
So thank you for writing this book. Again, the title of the book is The Adept Initiate's Guide to Luxor Temple, Experiencing the Temple of Man Using the Esoteric Symbolist Approach. And the author is NEXT. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
over water. I met her when winter rose up on the wind, the dark sky arriving as it fell, I watched her run. And passion swelled the banks, swallowed the saplings, and cut into the places desire yearns to wander. She pulled me to watch rich and rushing waves glisten and roll hypnotic, and chase her along the shallows to the bridge where we first kissed until she rolled beneath me and away as lovers will. Flowers in February start to show that she is everything, a mist to gently trace fingertips across my neck, or the frost that shines quietly in the morning hours, turning her muddy fever clear. Crystal glides over the river rock, like some secret treasure heart inside her chest. Or drifting in June, how, dancing with abandon, she hides and shows between the rocks, currents and turns, still cool from the lingering mountain snows. Enough to seduce the skinny dippers, who surrender, and again the soft eddy spins them like a newfound love, and released to dry themselves on her shoreline under the sun. And then brackish with moss in late summer, lying still with the water walkers, scattering her reflections of clouds and branches. Finished with the swimmers, giving what is left of her, comfort to seep into the roots, sun-drunk and sleepy, in the late hours of the season. And when the creek bed sits dry, I go down to the bottom, a stone that longs to be turned to sand, between the channeled soil and the hanging bare root walls. I lie down with my ear to the bottom and hear her still running in the dark, soft places of my heart. Mike Waltz.
American gypsies. There are no American gypsies living in trees, at least not yet. Only in canal zones, under freeways, in city parks. There are no colorful caravans, only colorful tents, old trailers, worn-out cars, always told to move on. There is no one breaking into song for the joy or melancholy of it, nobody dancing in the streets or breaking out the violin, no white-turbaned men, no women dressed in orange, pink, and gold, just the downtrodden, fallen between the ever-widening cracks, the addicted and abused, the unlucky, those cracked under too much stress, those without hope, those clinging to the last shred of it, the itinerant, the thieves, those just longing for a small patch of earth to call their own, for community. Many unable to help themselves do other than survive, hope beyond hope, for someone, anyone, to spare them a dime. Amy Gaffney.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.